We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses, people that were once in your shoes. Our TSBC alumni, speakers, and friends will shed light on growth strategies, resources, and inspiration to help you scale your creative business. Hey guys, I'm Katie Hunt, the founder of Trade Show Bootcamp, and welcome to Proof to Product. Today I sat down with Don Haney, the inventor of NerdWax. NerdWax is a wax-based product that helps to keep your glasses in place on your face. And NerdWax was launched on Kickstarter in 2014, and the following year they were featured on the television show Shark Tank. They've grown this business, Don, his wife, and his brother-in-law, to a $2 million business in 4 years. They still make their product in their home studio, and it's handmade in Nashville, Tennessee, and then shipped all over the world. On today's episode, we talked about managing risk, running a debt-free business, and why Don strives to work smarter, not harder. Hey, Don, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am really intrigued by your business journey, and I'm excited for everyone to hear about it. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us about NerdWax. What is it, and how did you come up with this idea?
Absolutely. So 10 years ago now, I was a touring audio engineer and I was on the road and we did a ton of outdoor concerts, summer festivals, and my glasses were always sliding off my face. And I tried all the solutions that I could find online that were either straps or hooks or croquet style band. Yep. And nothing that I tried worked for me. And so what I really wanted to do was make something that you couldn't tell that I was wearing, but that would just hold my glasses up when I was sweaty, or I have oily skin, so my glasses tend to slide anyway. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't setting out to like fix broken glasses. It was really just like, I want to wear my glasses that fit my face, but I don't want the optometrist or the optician to have to crank them down, because when you do that, it gives me headaches. And so it was just like this really frustrating thing for me, because I couldn't keep my glasses on my face and there wasn't anything there for me. And I had this kind of epiphany moment. I was working for an artist named Julianne Huff, and we were in Texas at a summer festival. She was on stage and her glasses were sliding, and she was wearing these big aviators and they just kept sliding down her nose, and she would have to stop playing guitar to push them back up. And it was just super awkward. And I was sitting on the side of stage and it was just like a light bulb moment for me. I was like, man, you know, Julianne has the same type of problem that I have, and she's not going to wear a hooker band or strap on stage. So right. It needs to be invisible. And thought, if surfers use wax on their boards in the water, I bet I could make something like that for your glasses. And then you could apply it to any type of glasses. You wouldn't see that you were wearing it, but it would just give you that extra friction. So I went home, I bought some surf wax, put it on my glasses, and ruined my first pair of glasses. Surf wax is meant to go on your board and it never comes off. And I got lenses and I ruined the anti-glare coating on my lenses. And I thought, okay, well, this isn't going to work. So I got to actually formulate something. So I started from scratch. I ordered all this stuff. I think my wife didn't even really believe that I was going to do this idea until like boxes of beeswax started showing up on her doorstep. And she was like, what is this stuff? And didn't really take it seriously until I was actually using it for myself, and people were coming up to me and they were like, where can I get some of this? And I remember one of the first times I put NerdWax on one of the guys that was on the road with us. I put it on his glasses and he was just like headbanging during the show. He was like, man, this is awesome. So I thought, you know, I think I have something here. Took it to Kickstarter. And this was actually through a whole series of events that happened in our lives. I had to change gigs. My wife broke her ankle. Our car broke down. Like all of this stuff all happened within a 2-week period in time. And so I shelved NerdWax and put it on hold and got 2 other jobs. And I was just trying to figure life out. And during that whole process, I had done some research for a podcast actually that I was working on. And the whole premise of the podcast was how to start a business without taking on debt or without taking on investment. Mm-hmm. Kickstarter was one of those platforms that I was researching. And through that process of researching Kickstarter for a podcast, I realized like, I could do this. Like, why am I sitting around? Like, I should just take one of my ideas. I have a box full of really terrible ideas in my basement that I never finished. And I just thought, man, if I could just take one of these ideas that I have and actually finish it and just prove it out, this would be a great way to do it. And I wouldn't have to go into debt. I wouldn't have to like spend a bunch of money on tooling or do something that would put me in a financial bind, but I could use what I had to make it then. So, went to Kickstarter. My goal is to raise $5,000 for the first production run. We ended up hitting that goal before lunch on the first day of the campaign.
Oh my gosh. What were you thinking when you saw that number hit the screen?
It was insane. Well, the really crazy part was that we launched at midnight. We had this whole like rollout strategy on how we were going to like roll it out to our friends and family. Mm-hmm. And the way Kickstarter works is you have to actually go live before they give you any of those links. So while I was getting ready, I realized, okay, well, we'll just launch it at midnight. We'll sleep on it. And then when we wake up in the morning, we'll have all those links. We'll send them to all our friends and we'll hit like the official go at 8 a.m. So I hit launch at midnight, like 2 minutes goes by and it's like, ding, you got your first backer. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't even tell anybody.
Who is zero marketing, zero.
No, nothing. And what? And I look and it's like some dude in Singapore and I realize, oh, it's in the middle of the day. And then ding, we have another backer. Well, while we slept, we raised $1,700 in our sleep from just people on the other side of the world who were like, oh, this is a cool idea. I'll give you 10 bucks. And that's really the power of the internet. If you really put yourself out there and you do it in a way where people get it, you can have that energy and it doesn't all have to be manufactured, which is such a huge blessing. Like we take that for granted today that we have so much access to so many people and people that are like us. Like if you were to take this to a VC, they would be like, yeah, what's the market size for people with glasses that slide down their face, you know, but like I can take my idea and I can go out there and just see how many people there are.
Yeah.
So anyway, hitting that goal, I woke up by the time I drove to work, we were already 3/4 of the way to our goal.
That's incredible. Congratulations on that. I mean, I know this was years ago, but congratulations. That's amazing.
No, it was incredible. It was such a wild feeling to see that number go up and to be like, wait, what have I done? Like, am I going to be able to fulfill all these orders? But
well, I do want to ask about that, but I also, it's proof of concept. It's proof that when you're solving a problem for people with your product and truly like helping people, that's when products like go crazy on their own, right? You don't have to build in all that marketing.
If you look at our original Kickstarter video, it was really attached to my story as a person and who I was and why I needed help with this idea. So the idea has to have merit, but then there's also this component of if you can tell your story and why you need that help, a lot of people just treat Kickstarter as a pre-sale. Like they don't need the money. They just think, oh, I'll just like take advantage of this marketing engine over here and I'll just ratchet up and take advantage of Kickstarter and Indiegogo at the same time and we'll just increase sales. And it's like people see through that. There was an authenticity and it is harder now. Like that was 2014. There's been 4 years of successful Kickstarters. And so there's it's a much more crowded space. It's a lot harder to get attention. But with that, the Kickstarter community, if you tell your story, it's a community of people like you who have ideas, who love new ideas, who love adopting new ideas, and they're totally willing to take that risk with you as long as it's a manageable risk. So I'm asking for 10 bucks. It's like, cool, I'll give this guy 10 bucks. And that like energy and that momentum that comes from that is huge. So by the end of the campaign, we had raised $60,000 from 2,800 backers.
Wow.
And it was incredible. And so that just started the journey. Then after that, we've had a lot of issues with manufacturing and fulfillment and all of those things. But
that's what I wanted to ask you. So it was still just a concept when you did the Kickstarter, right? Because you were getting the funding to produce the product. So then you had to go back and fulfill all these orders. So what was that timeline like for you?
So when you are planning a Kickstarter, one of the things that you have to prepare for is what happens if you happen to catch that wave right at the right time and hit that momentum swing, because you don't want to get upside down in a campaign. So I had looked at a lot of campaigns that their goal was to raise like $3,000 and they end up raising $300,000. And that amount of product, because Kickstarter is usually you have a physical product. Sometimes you'll have a digital product, but in the physical product space like mine, you have to then produce that product. And so one of them I'm thinking in particular was a Kickstarter from a guy in Brooklyn, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was he wanted to like bring back manufacturing to Brooklyn, and he started with like men's underwear, and he did this campaign and raised like 10x his goal or 100x his goal, something ridiculous. It was massive success, but he ended up losing like 30 grand on the project because his manufacturers couldn't set up. They knew they had him in a bind. And so they said, well, that volume wasn't the volume you agreed to. And then they just, you know, kind of they took him out and basically just stole a bunch of his money.
Right. Because he was in
a pinch and they knew it. And then there was a lot of other people who I saw who, you know, like your economies of scale are much better, but you don't plan for them and you don't plan for the loss. And like, so there's a lot of things you don't think through. So one of the things that I did in my campaign was I just did limited levels within a time frame that I felt was manageable. So the first 1,000 tubes I knew we could make by ourselves, and I knew we could do that in 2 weeks. And so I set up early bird levels and I set up the initial like stage in our Kickstarter to be fulfilled within that 2 weeks. And I limited it to that 1,000 units that I knew I could make. And then I gave myself 3 months to figure out the other stuff and all the other manufacturing. And we pushed that 3 month deadline. I thought it was way more than enough time, and we still pushed it. So the thing about Kickstarter though, is even though we pushed that deadline, people, if you are honest and open and you keep people updated and you keep people engaged, there's so much forgiveness within that community because they know you're figuring it out as you go. And so as long as you kind of fulfill on that promise to give them their rewards, they're super supportive through that.
Yeah.
But it's good to just think through that and think through that project timeline and to know that it's probably going to take you 5 times longer than you think it's going to take you.
I think that's the number one rule in business, frankly. Everything takes longer and tends to cost more as well. I know that's what we say about construction too, but you raised an interesting point about sometimes success can lead to failure if you're not planning for it, if you don't have things ready on the back end. I'm glad to hear that you were thinking ahead for that, but I've seen that in our world too with people that jump to working with large sales rep groups before they don't have the systems and the fulfillment processes like ready to then take on that type of volume. And it I don't want to say it sinks people because that sounds so dramatic, but it really does impact in a negative way.
No, it can sink you. I mean, that's the truth of it is a lot of people don't think about like what happens if this really takes off, you know? And the entrepreneurs are typically people who just get stuff done. And so they're like always doing and always going. I come from the other spectrum. That's like the perfectionist who like, I never ship things because I'm always like, I love ideas. I love getting them to like the point where like the work's going to happen. And then I quit because it's not interesting anymore. And my wife's the get it done person. And so she's always like, just do it. Like, just ship it. Like, it's good enough. Like, get it out. And I really had to overcome that, like that fear. And I think there's a balance. I think it's not something that you solve. I think that you understand what your personality type normally is, and then you have to learn to manage that tension. So if you are the like, I got to get it done person, then you got to take a little bit of time to do some strategy, to do some planning, and to just think through before you jump. And just because those the ready fire aim people, like, you just got to do some stuff in order, you know, otherwise you're just creating this wake behind you of turmoil for everybody on your team who is the detail oriented people. Mm-hmm. And then on the other people, you just got to ship it. Eventually you just got to like call it and ship it and go for it. And so there was a blend of that with my Kickstarter. And so we managed it in a way that I knew that I was going to be able to do the work. Like, that was the big thing. I knew I could do. Did I have everything figured out? No. I was like, I had never mailed anything other than just like going to the post office before. So I was like, I had no idea.
It's a whole other world.
No. And I opened up like international shipping and I was like, why in the world did I do that? That was such a bad idea. But but I figured it out. Like, and I made it happen. Like, you figure it out. So you're always kind of managing that. Like, you can never like mitigate risk entirely. Like, you have to take risk. You have to go out. You have to put yourself out there. But then on the other side of it, it's just like, you manage it. You make sure that it's not like you're just taking on more and more and more of it, because it'll sink you.
I 100% agree with you. As you were talking about your wife and your relationship with regards to your work ethic and your work style, I'm over here nodding my head because I am currently looking for a project manager for my team. I had one. She got a great job offer and since left. But I am that big picture, like push it out, get it out in the world. But I need that detailed. I need the yin to my yang, just like you have with your wife. So, okay. So you launched your Kickstarter in 2014. And a year later, you guys actually took the business on Shark Tank.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Was it intimidating? Was it exciting?
Yeah, that was another, like that would be a 2-hour podcast just talking about the ins and outs of Shark Tank. It was crazy. And you know, the thing about Shark Tank is you go and you film for Shark Tank, but that isn't a guarantee that you'll actually air on Shark Tank. And so you go and film in June and then you're sitting there waiting and you're trying to make all these business decisions because you know you're going to have this huge influx of people looking to your site and wanting to buy product and you need to know how much inventory to purchase. And when you're sitting there, you don't like what happens if they don't air my episode. And we have had friends that have gone on, they filmed their episode never aired, and then their deal fell through. Oh. And so like you can go on the show and think, oh man, this is going to be great and make all these decisions based on your episode airing. And then it doesn't air and they hold all the cards there. They really only tell you about 2 weeks before you air. So we had gone on in June, known that we were going to like knew what the outcome of the show was, but we're like so anxious of like, when are they going to air it? Like, I hope they do. And we were trying to make enough product. So I really just came down to like, okay, I'm going to make enough product that I know I can sell it within a year. And that's what I can afford to do. And I'm going to make that much product. And if we don't air, then cool. I'll just figure out a way to sell this product. But I'm going to, again, managing the risk, like knowing like I got a plan for this, but like I'm not going to put myself into a corner where we then are stuck with, you know, like a year's worth or two or three years worth of inventory that we can't sell. So I knew that I could move the inventory that I had coming in.
Okay, so you're planning ahead for this, but like, what were your goals for going on Shark Tank? Like, what did you want to get out of it? And two, we should tell everybody that you did turn down 2 offers while you're on the show.
I had 2 offers on the show, and we had a couple goals. The first goal was we had a manufacturing issue, and we were really hoping that one of the sharks would kind of have some, you know, buddy that in their back pocket or somebody in their network that would be able to help us with that. It's funny though, because none of that conversation made it into the episode. Like they completely left off all of those reasons.
Oh, Hollywood.
You're in there for an hour and a half and then they edit it down into 8 minutes. So that's one of the most nerve-wracking parts about Shark Tank is you don't know what out piece of that puzzle they're going to actually air. And you keep thinking that they're going to make me look like an idiot or what. But you know, like when they edit it down, it's really just, they take whatever's there and then they amplify it. Mm-hmm. You know? So if you're a little bit of a jerk, they're going to make you look like a lot of a jerk.
Which, by the way, you did not look bad. You sounded like you knew exactly what you wanted and needed. So,
and that was part of, you know, there was a couple other, they actually, Kevin actually countered with an offer that they didn't air on TV, but I didn't want to take it because if we would have taken a deal with him, we would have totally looked like suckers, like the way that the whole thing had gone down. And so that was one of the biggest things is I knew that from watching the show, public perception and how you're perceived when you're on the show is way more important than if you take a deal on the show or you don't take a deal on the show. And that's the thing that I really dug into while I was there is just thinking through, okay, I'm going on the show. I'm going to be in front of 9 million people on national television, represent the brand well, represent my family well, you know, like to do the things that I know to do. And so we rolled with that and the outcome was amazing. So once we aired on Shark Tank, that episode, we had like 130,000 in sales. We did that in the weekend after we aired on Shark Tank. So it was just like rocket ship.
Wow. Huge visibility for you. So I read.
No. That was the Saturday after we aired on Shark Tank. So one of the things that happens on Shark Tank all the time is companies go on, they get this huge influx in orders, and then they just totally screw their people because they don't prep for it. And so they don't know what the wave is going to be. They don't get ready for it. And then they don't ship product. And then it ends up just destroying their brand. So I went on with the goal of like, we're going to be able to ship as much as we can ship the day after we air. So we aired on a Friday night, and by Saturday morning we had 4,500 orders. And so we had, at the time I was teaching audio engineering, at a school in Brentwood, and I had all of my students like show up and paid them $12 an hour and fed them pizza. And we just like packed envelopes.
Wow. So
we packed out 30,000 orders, in that Saturday. We packed out 30 prepackaged 30,000 orders. So all I would have to do is put shipping labels on them. And then we physically shipped 4,500 of those orders, having never done anything like that before. It was insane. There was two label printers going, there was boxes and bins of envelopes. And I have video of us taking that. It was like a U-Haul truck full of envelopes.
I can't even imagine.
It was crazy. It was crazy. And the next day was the real, like, where we hit rock bottom, because we had all of these students helping us. I think we had probably like 15, 20 people. Mm-hmm. We had rocked through all of that. We got it packed up. We got it back to the house. I woke up Sunday morning and I click on into my Shopify and we have another 3,500 orders. And I was like, oh no, we don't have help. Like, we don't have anybody. Now it's just Lydia and myself. So we were calling family. They're like, we're kind of burnt out off after yesterday. Like, we just need a day to break.
Right. So what did you do?
We set the shipping printers to go, and we sat there all day with the kids, and we just labeled envelopes all day long.
You know, that story is so relatable though. I will tell you, I had a Thanksgiving. I vividly remember a Thanksgiving where I had all my family members packaging greeting cards and box sets of cards and all these things. And I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they all shipped in and did that. But like you said, you had that first wave with the family and friends. And then how quickly after that did you think about hiring, scaling up? You know, what about your infrastructure?
There's still, it's just me and my brother-in-law running the company right now. So my wife kind of gave her roles over to my brother-in-law, and then he's taken over all of operations. And now he's taken over a lot of things I was doing, like making wax and doing fulfillment, so that I could step up.
Are you still doing that in-house right now?
Yeah, we are.
Wow. So,
And that's because we've been looking for a manufacturing partner for a while. We actually finally found one, and we're really close to launching in this new container that we've been working on for the last 4 years. So really hoping that pans out now. But yeah, since we started, we've been making it by hand, every tube, and here in Nashville, and it's all sourced from the US. So it's like we've just DIY'd it from the beginning and stayed scrappy and kept going within our means. And you know, it's really hard. I think we probably could have scaled faster, but again, knowing the strengths, one of the things that when I set out for this business, one of the things that I knew I wanted is I'm a terrible manager. Like I'm not going to be a manager of people. I love ideas, but I wanted a very lean team, and I wanted something that I could do from anywhere. So the goal has always been to outsource manufacturing, outsource fulfillment, and run all that stuff. And we've had to make compromises on that because we're still manufacturing and fulfilling. And that's part of that managing the tension. Mm-hmm. So like I have the goal that I want to hit and I always want to be going in that direction. But then you're constantly oscillating between that and like what it takes to just get work done. And so, you know, that's been a big life lesson is, you know, like learning how to fail quickly and how to get it done. But it's I have it on my wall, actually. It says, hard work is never enough. More work is never the answer.
Yes.
And that's a Reid Hoffman thing, I think. And it rings true for me because it's like, you're going to reach a point where you just can't throw more bodies at it. You can't throw more time at it. You can't throw more energy at it. You got to work smarter. And then there's times where it's like, no, you just got to like put your shoulder down and just dig in and do some work. And so you're constantly managing that tension of like work harder, work smarter, work harder, work smarter. And if I had a book, that's all it would say, like the whole book.
Yeah, I hosted a conference called Business Camp a few years back, and that was our tagline, work smarter, not harder. And it was mostly about building that foundation, systems, processes, bringing on help when it made sense. But I will say there's a lot to be said for staying small and nimble and, you know, definitely working within your means so you're not stretching yourself. I know for you that it's been a real priority to remain debt-free and to grow debt-free. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
It's hard. It's hard when you're trying to manage a cash business. One of the big things, because after we had that huge Shark Tank wave, everybody was like, oh man, that must feel so great. But I had all these like big spends that I wanted to do for manufacturing. And at the time I thought I was going to like custom mold this container and it was going to cost a couple $100,000. And because we made all of our money in October, we had November and December to try to spend that money in the business. Otherwise we're going to lose it. And it came down to it. And I lost almost 35% of all of that influx to taxes.
Oh.
Like the most depressing thing to write that check and just watch it all walk right back out the door. And learning timing, like that was just, I couldn't have planned for that. And like, awesome. Like whatever, it happens. But learning like, oh, I can't order inventory in December. Like I need to actually like order my inventory in January, like when I know what I'm going to do with it for the year. And you know, there's all those things that you learn from just making mistakes. And when you take on debt, a lot of the times it's like you just think, oh, well, if I had the resources, this wouldn't be an issue. And sometimes that is true. I liken it to like debt being a rope. And so that rope, you just need to know who's on the other end of it, because the rope can help you get over the wall or it can tie you up behind the wall. And you just got to know like how much rope there is. And you got to make sure you don't have so much slack that you're going to get caught up in that and tied up. And so we had been there in our personal lives. And so doing that in the business, it's been rough. It's been rough at times to like figure out how to manage cash flow. But luckily I have a huge margin on my product. So that allows me some wiggle room to make mistakes and to figure things out. And that's the thing that I would say, if you're like planning out your product or you don't have room to take care of your customers, like make it, like figure out how to create the business that allows you to have margin to grow more efficiently. Because the other way, just it's more of a binary option. You know, you either make it or you don't. And so in this way, we've managed to like figure out how to do things when you get scrappy, you just figure it out. And so that's something you don't always do if you have the luxury of just having cash in the bank account.
I agree with you on that one. Let's talk a little bit about customer service. You've touched on it with regards to your Kickstarter, how you wanted to make sure that you're getting things out quickly, and also with Shark Tank, being prepared to service this larger audience that you're being in front of. What are you doing on a regular day-to-day basis when you don't have this great influx, but what are you doing to create a great customer experience for the people buying from you, whether it's during their sales process or even once they're receiving your product?
Yeah, this is one of those things that like is so, we try to overcomplicate it, but it's so basic. Just like treat people the way you want to be treated. It's just like the golden rule. It's like, it's so easy. Like just don't get into a fighting. Like this came from my time. I worked at the Apple store for a while and at the Genius Bar, fixing computers and fixing phones. And it just makes your life easier when you assume positive intent. Just as somebody might be taking advantage of you. So what? Who cares? Like just roll past that one person, because there's 9 other people behind that person who have an actual problem. And the more time you spend with that one person that just makes your life a living hell, the more it just drains you. And so I just set out really early, knowing what I knew at Apple, I just made our return policy super simple. If you don't like it, you just let us know. We'll shoot you a refund. Like super easy. And when you have bigger margins, you can do that. And you can allow yourself that flexibility to do that. And I think it's like, you know, L.L. Bean does that. Madewell does that. There's a lot of companies that have that like customer confidence. And when you do that, it creates a so much easier to manage the customer experience because you don't get into these like, well, can you prove it? Or what is, you know, and you assume positive intent and you roll with that person and you do right by the customer. And then that feeds on itself. And when you do that with enough people, that just even I've had people that didn't like the product themselves, but then they wanted a refund. So I gave them a refund. They were like, well, I'll ship the two back. And I was like, no, just keep it or give it to a friend. And then they'll be like, oh, that's amazing. And then they give it to a friend. And who knows? Maybe it just went in the trash. I don't know, but maybe it got handed to a friend and that person told somebody and then it resulted in another sale. So I'm not saying, I understand people have different issues with how they manage their returns in a physical space. But if you can give yourself more margin and you can assume positive intent and then you can just treat people the way that you want to be treated, that's what it comes down to. Yeah. You know, just do good work and follow through for people. We've been really great at that piece. The piece that we struggle with is the like going out. We've never had to like pay for advertising before. And we're just now getting into that piece of like emailing people and doing paid advertising and social advertising and all of that. And that's a whole nother beast because I'm trying to get my brain out of that. Like it's just been playing catch up and trying to like make sure. But the one thing that we have done well is we always respond to people on social media. We always respond to people via email. So if you send us an email, we respond. Like that's just what happens. And we usually respond quickly and we usually take care of your issue quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you just focus on those really simple things, it creates an amazing customer experience that you don't get 80% of the time. Mm-hmm. Because 80% of the time, it's just such a hassle. And if you make it really easy, it doesn't just make the customer experience great, it makes your life easier as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. And you're dealing with happier, easier to deal with customers. I'm not phrasing that right, but you know what I mean? Like you're not feeling that negativity that you talked about.
When you have that negative person, the more that you push back, the more it just fuels them. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I learned at Apple. I was like, you have the iPhone and it has changed civilization as we know it. And people still complain about it. They like whine about it. Like you can have the most amazing life-changing invention and somebody will still complain about it. So you can't take that stuff super personally. You just have to like take it and then move forward and you take it and you learn from it and you take what works, you take what doesn't work and you throw it out, you know? Like, so that's the thing is like just responding in a way that you understand what's helpful and to you as far as feedback, because if you listen to your customers, they're going to give you what your customer roadmap, they're going to give you the map forward for your business if you just listen. And so all of the things that we're working on, the product improvements we're working on, I mean, it all comes from direct feedback from our customers.
Right.
So if you listen, not only are you creating that good customer experience, you're also giving yourself a way forward and you're giving yourself a way to progress your product and improve on it.
Absolutely. I want to take a step back real quick. You have built a $2 million business without paid advertising, without email marketing, without a true strategy plan around social media.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Major kudos to you.
Although, you know, it's like one of those like things where you go, we've done over 2 million in gross sales. Would somebody give me $2 million for the business? Probably not. Like, so is it really worth 2 million? Like there's that question of like, when you're in it and you're grinding out, all you do is see the challenges. So it's good to, like you said, like look up and go, oh wow, like this is kind of remarkable. Like,
it's very remarkable. You should be very proud. Thank you. Yeah. Well, what advice? I mean, you've dispensed a lot of great advice already just through your story and how you've navigated things. But what advice would you give to somebody that is at the very beginning stages of creating a product, you know, and starting up their product-based business? If you could go back and tell yourself something when you were starting, what would it be?
Yeah, it's something that did not come natural to me. And I learned, which is make it with what you have. And so a lot of times when you're starting out, you think, oh, if I just had the money, or if I just had more time, or if I just had a team, or if I just had better artwork, like fill in the blank. If I just had this, then I'd be able to do it. And the truth is you wouldn't, because you're not doing it now. So instead of looking at what you're doing and going, if I only had these things, flip it and go, what could I do with what I have today? And so that gives you a whole nother starting place. So you think backwards from there, and that opens the possibility. So a lot of times we don't want to build the box around it because it feels confining, it feels restrictive, but that box is what helps you to make something. So when you set out to make something, the possibilities are endless. You can make anything. If I was just like, make a widget, you'd be like, what am I going to make? And you have to start narrowing it down. That's what building the box is. So you build that box and you narrow yourself in into what you're going to make. Well, if you think you're going to make one thing and you don't have the resources for that, think, what could I make with what I have today? And how do I transition it into that? And there may be something that looks like the thing you thought you were going to make, but is one step in between not making it and making the thing you really hope to make. And if you can take those incremental steps, it'll get you there a lot quicker than if you just kind of wait and hold out for the making the grand thing. And so, you know, we always hear people talking about, you know, the MVP and the minimum viable product. And it's just true. How you get things done is you start small and then you just work up. And if you have no experience, like starting small, a lot of times, like, all I wanted to do is make 1,000 tubes of Nerdwax. And it just took off. And I figured it out as I went. But what I did was I said, how do I do this thing with what I have today? Mm-hmm. Well, I have Kickstarter. That's a platform I can use. I have some video skills and I have a friend that'll come help me make a video, put that together. I have a little tiny bit of design coding skills. Cool. I can do all the graphics for myself. I can take some pictures with my iPhone. I can make little GIFs. Like all of that stuff was like, what can I do with what I have? And that's what you need to do to get started. Just ask yourself that question. How do I make it with what I have today?
Do you think a lot of entrepreneurs overthink things, especially at the beginning?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I agree with you.
Yep.
I think it's easy to get caught up in that, but we need to take a step back sometimes and say, to your point, what can I do with what I have available to me?
Yeah. And I ask myself that all the time because I get into these like, oh, if we just had this, it would make it so much easier. And then I go, hey, well, I don't have that. And a lot of times if you go, okay, you take that step back and you go, what can I do with what I have today? It will get you on a path that then will get you to the thing that you wish you had. Mm-hmm. So you then see the path to that thing. Whereas like when you think in the restrictive way of like, I see these barriers, they just hold you back. And so the other way just creates a path.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the overthinking things also creates, we're creating our own barriers. We're getting in our own way is what I'm trying to say. And we just need to get out of our way. So what's next for Nerdwax? What do you guys have coming up? What do you want to share with us?
All those things of like launching into paid advertising.
Yes.
Which is not for you, but we're making our product better. That's what we're doing. That's the next phase is like, it's been an uphill battle, but we finally, I think, are making some progress on it. I think we're really close, but I've been beaten down so many times on it that I'm just like, I'm not going to say it until we're there. We actually have it in hand. But I think we're really close to finally having this better applicator that we've been working on for the last 4 years. We launched last fall, we launched some fun microfiber cloths. So, you know, your optometrist or you know, you buy your sunglasses at Sunglass Hut and they're always like, clean it with this lens cloth so you don't scratch the lenses and like you just throw the cloth away. And so we thought maybe if we give some lens cloths to people that are fun, that actually clean their glasses with them. So we made one that looks like a slice of pizza and one that looks like a taco.
How fun.
Unicorn. So we started with all the internet memes and then we're going to branch out from there. But really to build upon the glasses accessories as a brand. So we'll probably have, you know, some lens cleaner kits and other eyewear accessories to round it out. But our hero product is really Nerdwax, and that's what we focus the most on.
Okay, so this is really interesting to me because one of the things we talk about a lot with our audience is branching out into other product categories, you know, complementary items that can be packaged well together or sold as a kit or a gift or whatever it might be. How far into your business journey did you stretch your wings into other categories?
I mean, I was ready at day one. I had my next like five product ideas, but
of course.
I waited. Yeah, I waited 2 years before I really launched something. And it was really at the point, I think if I would have done it sooner, we might have had more traction. But it was me trying to work on a lot of different problems. Again, it's sometimes when you have more resources, it bogs you down. And so I was kind of moving in five different directions at one time, and it just took me a long time to do all of those things. I think if I was going to do it over again, I would go back and I would just refocus. I would get a little less, like I'd open up my hands a little bit. I held the brand a little too tight at the beginning, and I was too like in love with some of my ideas in the first couple years where I was like, no, it has to be this way. Like, this is what I'm going to, and I just drug it out for too long. And so I think, you know, being 4 years into this, I've learned a lot that like, just fail quicker, you know, like don't drag things out. If it's not working, like figure out a new path and transition quicker. And just, cause it just, the world doesn't wait for you. You know, your customer base does not wait for you. They just move on and there's somebody else right behind it. And so you just got to like, the thing that you have to do is when you have the idea, you have to be able to execute on that idea. If you can't execute on the idea, then it's a bad idea. And that's what I really had to learn is like, you have a lot of bad ideas, Don, and they might be really great ideas. And to me, I love them. They're like phenomenal ideas, but it's like, can you execute on them? No, then it's a bad idea for you. It's maybe a great idea for somebody else, but it's a bad idea for you.
Well, okay. So this is what I wanted to ask. Was it that you couldn't execute on them just from a logistical standpoint, or was it more of a fear thing holding you back?
Oh, no, I don't get afraid about that kind of stuff. Let me try to give you a good example of one. So when we were trying to figure out this new applicator, one of the things that I wanted to do was a custom container. And I wanted it to look really cool and have a triangle shape. Gotcha. And I wanted it to have a slant tip and have all these like features. Then I got into engineering and how much you look at a lip balm tube and it looks really, really simple, but there's actually five pieces to it. And each piece has all these little like micron details that all are engineered to do specific purposes. And then you find out like when you're making plastic injection molds that like making triangles is hard or making certain shapes is hard. And oh, there's a cylinder shape because of this, or, you know, like you have your design idea and you feel like it's a really good idea, but then you go into actually executing on it and you learn all of the reasons why that thing doesn't exist in the world. Right. And so that's where it's like, just because it's a good idea or it's like a cool design doesn't mean that it'll actually make it into real life. And mm-hmm. So that gap there is really big. And for me, the execution piece is like, once I get to a bigger platform and I have more resources and I have more time, then cool. I can take on those projects that are really hard and really complicated. But for now, there's all this like low hanging fruit that is just rotting on the ground, you know, because it's like, I'm just letting it go because I'm trying to climb the tree and grab the one up top. Like, no, just like grab the stuff around you. It takes so much less work. It will give you so much more momentum, and just shipping and executing gives you so much more energy than letting an idea die over multiple years. That is the most frustrating like thing in the world. So just like, don't get caught in that cycle. Ship and ship often and fail often and like execute quick.
Love it. What have you learned about yourself through this whole process of starting this business and growing this business?
I have a lot of ideas. Fair enough. We kind of covered that one. But yeah, I've learned that. I've learned, one of the things we kind of touched on this earlier, but is just that when you're building a business, there's going to be all of the social pressures of the other businesses around you and what you think you should be doing, you know, top line revenue, everybody's talking about, and you like say, $2 million in revenue. You're like, oh man, that sounds so amazing. But I'm like, I look back at the last 4 years and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's been such a grind. And like, yeah, there's been really awesome things that have happened. And like, it's been a huge blessing in our life. But it's also like when you're climbing the mountain, all you see is the rocks in front of you. And all of you see is the challenges. And you got to turn around and like, look out once in a while. And I've learned with myself, I just push forward and I just keep going and I keep climbing and I got to take time to stop and take time to reflect and then just slow down and not be so stressed out all the time. I mean, part of that is what gives you the drive to get going and to become an entrepreneur and to go And so you don't want to lose all that, you know, you want to manage that tension too, like doing that, but like not doing that at the expense of your family or your friends or like, you know, cause life is short, you know, you only have a finite amount of time on this planet. And if you're just focused on the mountain in front of you, like you're going to just die on the mountain. And like, what's the point? You know, enjoy the journey as you go.
Absolutely. I just interviewed Rosie O'Neill from Sugarfina, the candy company. And she said, she's talking about self-care in a similar way. She was saying that, you know, the to-do list is never ending. As an entrepreneur, there's always new things coming onto that to-do list. And if you don't make a point to stop and do the things that, you know, are going to fuel you as a person, you're just, yeah. You know what I'm trying to say. It's just this
picture. I grew up in Tahoe. And so we would have these storms and they would just dump like 4 feet of snow in a few hours. Like it would just be like dumping. And I remember being a little kid and like going out there with my shovel and trying to shovel it as it's snowing.
Yes.
And how you think like, oh, this is like, I'm making an impact, but then there's just more snow. And then you leave and you come back and everything that you shoveled is now covered in snow. And it's like, that is the mental picture that I get is like, sometimes you just got to like wait till the storm passes and then go out and get back to work, you know, but you need that rest. I also think of it like surfing. Like if you're always like paddling, like watch good surfers. They're not always paddling. They paddle at the right moment and they paddle with like really like high intensity in a couple passes right at the right time. It's all about finding timing in between waves. If you're sitting out there like trying to make waves in the ocean, like you're never going to get anywhere. Like you have to wait for the wave to come. And so life comes in waves, seasons come in waves, and there's going to be times where you need to like get on the gas and you need to be full throttle and driving hard. And there's times where you need to let off the gas because there's a corner coming. And if you don't let off the gas, you're going to crash.
Yeah. So
you got to pace yourself.
I absolutely agree with you. Before we go, can you tell us where people can find you online, where they can purchase your products, where they can follow you on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. We're NerdWax on all the things, NERDWAX and nerdwax.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on the show and sharing your story. As I've done this podcast and talked to so many different entrepreneurs, not only in my space, but in other product categories, it's so fascinating to see the common threads as well as, you know, some of the differences. But there's a lot more common threads through product-based businesses of all types. So
absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And it was fun.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, are you preparing for trade show season and having a tough time dealing with all the details? Well, I have a new free on-demand workshop that will help you maximize your trade show investment and keep wholesale orders coming in long after your trade show ends. If you're interested in joining me for this free masterclass, head on over to theboothblueprint.com to sign up. Again, that's theboothblueprint.com. I look forward to having you. Proof to Product is brought to you by Trade Show Bootcamp and hosted by me, Katie Hunt. Since 2011, TSBC has worked with hundreds of product-based businesses to help them uplevel, scale, and build profitable, sustainable companies. You can find our show notes and additional resources at prooftoproduct.com. And if you like what you heard today, please head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star review and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode.